Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, welcome back to the New Books Network. My name is Adam Bobek, and I'm a PhD candidate in sociocultural anthropology at the University of Leipzig. It's a real pleasure today to welcome Professor Steve B. Lee to the program to discuss Django Generations, Hearing Ethno-Race, Citizenship, and Jazz Manouche in France, published in 2021 with the University of Chicago Press. Professor Lee is Assistant Professor of Music at the University of Maryland, and I should also mention that the book won the William A. Douglas Prize in Europeanist Anthropology from the Society for Anthropology of Europe. Professor Lee, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Adam. It's great to be here.
What inspired you to put this book together?
So this book grew out of my dissertation, but the project itself actually goes back to when I was a teenager. So I am a violinist and a violist, and I'm primarily classically trained. But in high school, I started getting into jazz. And one of the first models I was guided to for string-based jazz was the music of Django Reinhardt, whom, of course, I'm going to talk about in a little bit. But I looked to his music as well as that of his longtime collaborator, the violinist Stefan Grappelli. So after high school, when I was in college at Boston University, I did one of those make up your own major programs in anthropology and gastronomy, actually. So I had a focus on food studies, and I started doing a lot of ethnographic research at that point and ended up writing a thesis based on a couple of years of ethnographic field work on the slow food movement and organization. But during this whole time, I kept up my interest in playing jazz, learning about jazz. And then also I started exploring more of the history and the cultural foundations of the music that Reinhardt and Grappelli played. And so that led me to become very interested in learning about Romanies, which is the ethno-racial group to which Reinhardt belonged. So while I'm introducing this, just to be clear, I use the term Romanies to refer to members of an ethno-racial group that traces its origins to Northwest India and that is currently most populous throughout Europe. Now, they're often known somewhat pejoratively as gypsies and are subject to a lot of stereotyping, whether it's in terms of criminality and poverty, or the more romanticizing stereotypes that they are inherently free-spirited and nomadic, which most are not. But so that's kind of how Romani people often get perceived in popular media. So Reinhardt belonged to the Manouche subgroup of Romani people. And Manouche are the people for which the musical genre Jazz Manouche is named. And of course, I'll talk a bit more about that genre in a sec. But I started learning about Romanies on my own through reading and looking at media and all that kind of thing. And then I studied abroad in France and was exposed to the Jazz Manouche scene there. And then after college, I took a couple of years off to work before deciding to apply to grad school. And then during that time, before I started grad school, I decided to do an independent ethnographic project on improvisational pedagogy at the New England Conservatory in Boston. And I was really interested in questions about how creativity is both taught and practiced within institutions like conservatories that tend to have a more kind of traditional, more rigid curriculum. And I wanted to learn about how students and faculty conceptualize their own more individualized creative practices within the confines of this institution. So I was really interested in basically in like, how do you teach creativity? And then when I started my PhD at NYU in 2010, I initially envisioned a dissertation project that was going to be about string improvisation and pedagogy more broadly. But then after I moved to New York, I became familiar with the jazz manouche scene in New York. And then I also traveled a bit to France and researched what it was like there. I became so intrigued by the political dimensions of this music and then with Romani representation in general, that I decided to focus on jazz manouche as my dissertation topic. And I was especially curious about how Django Reinhardt appeared to be on the one hand, this kind of national hero for French music, but then on the other hand, he was also considered to be this hero for manouche people who were otherwise quite marginalized within French society. So I wanted to understand how people thought about this music as being both very familiar within French society, but then also having this kind of exotic edge to it. And I also wanted to see how manouche people might also be using this music in a kind of activist sense to promote awareness of who they were. So those were some of the motivations to bring me to what I ended up researching. I was also encouraged by a very close friend and colleague of mine, Dr. Petra Gelbart, who is a Romani ethnomusicologist and activist. And so with her, I worked on a number of various musical and awareness raising projects while I was doing my coursework in New York. And then during that time, I also really started building my network of Romani activists and scholars and musicians. And eventually all of this led me to embark upon a full year of dedicated fieldwork in 2013 to 2014. And then I did a number of smaller fieldwork stints thereafter. And I continue to go back to France whenever I can. But I had been initially, I'd been planning to do most of my field work in and around Paris, because that's really where the kind of commercial locus of this music is. But when I got there in 2013, whenever I'd start telling people about my project and what I was interested in researching, they would just tell me that I had to go to Alsace. For anyone who's not familiar, Alsace is a region in eastern France. It borders Germany. And so I was told that that is where the quote unquote real jazz manouche was happening. And eventually enough people told me that I said, okay, I'll move to Strasbourg. So I did. And then that's basically the basis of this project. And as I explain in detail in the book, it's really both an ethnographic project as well as an archival project that spans basically the years from the 1930s up until right before I published the book.
I love the title of this book. Could you explain the title of this book for listeners?
Sure. Thank you. That was took a long time to develop. But so the full title is Django Generations, Hearing, Ethno-Race, Citizenship, and Jazz Manouche in France. And I'll just break down a few bits of this title, starting with Django, the most obvious part of the title. So among his fans, Django Reinhardt is typically known just as Django. He's on a first name basis with most of his listeners. And he, as I mentioned before, he was a manouche Romani guitarist who he eventually became known as Europe's most famous jazz musician. And I think that's a title that he probably still holds today. Like his fame was really, really huge. So he was born in 1910, and he grew up primarily in France within a family of professional musicians. And then starting in the 1930s, he became especially well known for his really innovative approach to improvisation in jazz. And he's in developing this style, he really also developed a new level of prestige for the guitar as a solo instrument in jazz, which it had not really risen to that level before, at least on such a large scale. And I should also probably note that jazz, by this point in time, by the 1930s, jazz had already become a pretty huge industry in France. Jazz had been globalizing out of the United States since basically the 1910s through the 20s. And there was already like a fairly well-established jazz industry at this point. So he was kind of building on the popularity that jazz already had at this time. So Django performed throughout the 1930s, throughout the 1940s, even under Nazi occupation, which, you know, he still managed to thrive in these underground jazz clubs and even earn the attention of some Nazi officers who really enjoyed and appreciated his music. And then after the war, he continued to play quite a bit. He even went on tour to the U.S. at the invitation of Duke Ellington. And kept playing with a number of really well-renowned jazz musicians through the early 1950s. During his lifetime, he made over 900 recordings that we know of. And then in 1953, he died suddenly from a brain hemorrhage. And so, you know, his journey was cut off then, but his legacy has continued to grow ever since his untimely death. So he remains, as I said, a really important figure in jazz, and he's actually one of the very few non-American jazz musicians to have earned this level of recognition. I should also mention that one of the things that Django is most well known for is his disability. So this is a story that when people start learning about Django, it's like one of the most kind of gripping aspects of his life. But in 1928, when he was 18 years old, he survived a fire in his caravan that put him in the hospital for about a year. So among other injuries to his body, his left arm and his left hand became so severely burned that he developed some really deep scarring on the back of his left hand that ended up causing his ring and pinky fingers to kind of retract and become basically not unusable, but they lost most of their function. And so for a guitarist, you can imagine this is an incredibly devastating injury. But during his time in the hospital, he basically retrained himself to be able to play using mainly his index and middle finger, as well as his thumb, which is not standard in most guitar practice. So he's considered to be a real role model for the fact that he persevered so much and became such an illustrious musician, despite only being able to work with just three fingers most of the time. So that's one aspect of his legacy as well. Another key part of this book's title is Jazz Manouche, which I referred to already briefly as a musical genre that's named after Manouche people. And I detail the development of this genre in the first couple chapters of the book. And I talk about the political and economic implications of this genre throughout the book. But in a nutshell, Jazz Manouche is a style of jazz that's based mostly on Django's recorded work, which is fairly rare for a genre to emerge out of the work of basically just one person, but this is what it became. So it's very imitative of the style that he developed during his lifetime and along with other musicians as well. And a Jazz Manouche ensemble is typically pretty small, so you usually have between three and six or seven musicians, usually between three and six, and it's very, very centered on the guitar. So in any given ensemble, you'll usually have at least two guitars, often more, along with a double bass and often other instruments such as the violin, the accordion, clarinet. And Jazz Manouche ensembles typically don't include percussion instruments. And this is mainly because the rhythm guitar fills this percussive role through a technique that's known as la pompe, which literally means the pump, which is very illustrative of what it actually sounds like. And it's a very brisk kind of right hand strumming technique that gives the music a kind of very bouncy percussive feel. So that's one of the main hallmarks of the musical style. I can only get us so far in describing the style with words. I think it's one of those things that you just kind of have to listen to fully understand what it's all about. So if anybody is curious about this, I'd like to direct them to the book's website, which is www.djangogen.com. And there I have a bunch of examples that can give you a sense of what this music sounds like. But another thing else I'll say about the genre itself is that it's called jazz manouche not only because Django himself was manouche, and it's basically a genre that's in honor of him, but also because the people who essentially created the genre were in large part manouche people as well. So one thing I also want to note is that during Django's lifetime, he had no conception of jazz manouche. That just did not exist. And he considered himself to be a jazz musician above all. That is what he was trying to do, regardless of his ethno-racial background. And so it wasn't until the late 1960s and mainly the early 1970s, so almost two decades after his death, that a number of manouche musicians started to play music in his style. And then from there, they developed an entire genre. So this was really a familial, community-based practice that grew partly out of an attraction to Django's music, but it also grew out of a perceived need to develop a practice, or you might even say a brand, that could serve manouche constituencies in both political and economic realms. So what I really tried to do in the first part of this book is to push against the rather popular narrative that Django himself invented jazz manouche, and that it's been this unbroken tradition since his lifetime, going all the way from the mid-20th century to the present day. And instead, I wanted to show how a whole genre was invented and relatively quickly became the main thing that manouche people are known for. And then I also wanted to show, at least in part, that there are a lot of non-manouche people who also perform and consume this music, which complicates the idea that this is a uniquely manouche music. So that kind of throws a bit of a wrench into the narrative as well. But just to get back to the title, to say a little bit more of the title, I decided to call the book Django Generations, in part because I thought the alliterative aspect was catchy. And I'll admit that I went through a lot of different words that begin with a J sound to see what I could put along with Django. This is a pretty typical naming convention in a lot of kind of jazz manouche or Django themed media. But so, you know, I wanted it to sound fun, but I was also thinking of generations itself in a few different ways. So one sense is in terms of time periods, which reflects how I trace Django's legacy across these different historical moments and how he's come to signify a lot of different things depending on the demands of the time period. Another sense of generations reflects how jazz manouche is a very intergenerational practice within some manouche communities, and it's something that's really passed down between generations and connects people of different generations. And then finally, I think of generations in the literally generative sense, in that Django and jazz manouche have been taken up to produce various ideologies about identity and difference, to produce different kinds of histories, different subjectivities, and so on. So I'm really kind of making this term generations do a lot of work in that title.
You developed this concept in the book of ratiosemiotics. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So ratiosemiotics is a relatively newly coined term within anthropology, and it builds on a couple of intersecting legacies that are within or adjacent to linguistic anthropology. I should mention also that technically my degree is in music. I consider myself both an ethnomusicologist and an anthropologist, and within that, a linguistic anthropologist. So a lot of my thinking is really informed by the field of linguistic anthropology. So first you have this kind of semiotic anthropology that seeks to understand how communication works across a whole range of communicative or semiotic, we could say, modalities. And semiotic anthropology also seeks to understand how questions of power and political economy are part and parcel of the observable semiotic process or processes. So you have that. And then more recently, there's been a branch of study that's developed called raciolinguistics. And here I'm thinking mainly of the work of scholars like H. Sammy Aleem and Jonathan Rosa, Nelson Flores, and a number of others who are committed to exploring how racial categories and language ideologies become mutually constitutive. So now with raciosemiotics, I'm drawing on the work of the linguistic anthropologist Crystal Smalls, who uses raciosemiotics to essentially expand the scope of raciolinguistics to include a broader array of semiotic modalities. And that's why I find it to be such a fitting framework to talk about Jasminouche, because Jasminouche is something that is constituted not only discursively, but of course, sonically, as well as visually and even somatically. And so what I'm really trying to explore is not only just how racial categories are reflected in the way that people talk about or perform or otherwise experience Jasminouche, but I'm also trying to show how racial difference can be constituted through these very practices, and also how the range of semiotic modalities that a musical practice like Jasminouche, or really any other musical practice for that matter, how this range of modalities can have significant effects on the political and economic opportunities that are available to the people who engage with this music, and especially people who are ascribed a marginalized status, such as Manouche people in France. So this gets me into another key aspect of the book, coming yet again back to the title, which is my use of the term ethno-race. And ethno-race is a term that was coined by David Theo Goldberg, and he used this term to acknowledge the contingency of the terms race and ethnicity as separate terms, and how each of them are ways of ascribing some kind of fundamental social difference to individuals or groups of people. So in the context of this book, I use ethno-race to emphasize just how slippery the categories of race and ethnicity are, especially because in a lot of the archival and ethnographic work that I did, I found that each of these terms gets used in somewhat interchangeably depending on what someone's trying to say about a particular person or a group of people. And in France, generally speaking, people nowadays avoid using the word race or talking about race, but they often use ethnicity as a kind of euphemism for race. So this in turn gets me into another kind of key fundamental aspect of the book. And this has to do with complexities of French racial politics. So the French state technically does not recognize any race, ethnicity, or religion as an identity category. So the state doesn't collect demographic data along any of these lines. And then French institutions generally consider themselves to be totally colorblind, regardless of the reality on the ground. So this whole policy is was developed in part because France is a deeply assimilationist state. So if you're a French citizen, you are expected to be French on French terms, regardless of your own ethno-racial or religious background. And if you identify too strongly with a particular group, usually a particular non-white group, you might be considered to be communitarian or separatist, that you're not, considering yourself as fully French as you're expected to be. So this colorblind policy, it obviously does not, as I said, does not reflect the reality on the ground, which is that people are differentiated all the time in racial terms. It is inescapable. And so this makes it really hard for a racially minoritized person and having to face this paradox in which you're told that on the one hand, your racial identity is irrelevant or in the eyes of the state doesn't exist, and yet you live this categorization, this identity every single day. So this is one way I think that a ratio-semiotic approach can become really productive, because if you don't have easy avenues for naming and talking about race, it becomes really important to pay attention to how all of the semiotic modalities through which race takes shape actually operate together. It's not just how you talk, it's how you experience all of these different communicative processes together. And so I'm looking at Jasminouche as one really semiotically rich area through which ideas about Manouche and Romani ethno-race more broadly actually take shape. One more kind of framing I'll give for this as well is the actual development of Romani ethno-race in France. So Manouche people, I should make clear, they've lived in France for centuries. Romani migration itself, it began out of Northwest India basically a millennium ago, where nobody's entirely sure exactly when, but about around the year 1000, people started migrating out of Northwest India and made their way slowly westward to the European continent. And so Romanis first appeared, according to official documentation, in the 15th century in France. So there's, you know, been various forms of migration since then, but Manouche people, who call themselves Manouche people, have been there for quite a while. Despite this, they have pretty much always been treated as second-class citizens. So in the 20th century, you see this second-rate citizenship take shape really starkly through a variety of events and policies, going back to a form of legislation that was passed in 1912 that designated all people who lived in some form of mobile housing. This legislation designated them as nomads, and essentially created a special class of citizenship for them. And so these people who were suddenly forced into this category faced way more police surveillance than the general population did, and all different kinds of discrimination. This legislation was developed ostensibly on the basis of the chosen lifestyle of these so-called nomads. But it was a well-known fact that most people who fit the parameters of nomads within this policy were indeed Romani. And the legislators themselves didn't exactly conceal the fact that they were trying to get around France's colorblind policy by, in effect, redesignating a racial group based on their behavior or so-called behavior. So that legislation has been reformed numerous times over the years, but it is still on the books, and it continues to have some really devastating repercussions for the people who are subject to it. Considering all of that, Manouche people in Alsace have long been considered to be second-class citizens, over the last several decades, Jazz Manouche has really been considered to be one of the most promising, if not the most promising, means for them to prove their value to society, even if it comes at certain costs.
And here we really get into the ambiguities of Django's legacy, right? Because despite being Manouche, he saw himself primarily just as a jazz musician, as many other jazz musicians. And in France today, his legacy has really got this pull and push between people who say, no, Django Reinhardt is French. We don't classify him as Manouche. Could you maybe talk about that and how Jazz Manouche became really popular starting in maybe the 2000s?
Yeah, this push and pull around the around what Django should represent is really kind of at the heart of a lot of this, a lot of the tensions that surround the Jazz Manouche itself. I'll say a bit about kind of how it took shape. It really, as I mentioned before, began to develop in the late 60s, early 70s with some Manouche communities who took a liking to Django's music. And then over time, they decided that this was something that they really wanted to pursue, both in a collective and an individual sense. And what they were doing wasn't really considered to be a distinctive genre at the time that they started doing it, because they were just playing Django's music because they liked it. But as it became more and more evident that Manouche musicians could really capitalize on this music as their own music and as something that was considered really ethno-racially specific to them, they started to make inroads into the music industry and then developing this kind of Manouche brand of this music, oftentimes with the help of nonprofit organizations and others. So the music became, on the one hand, this non-commercial family practice, and it also became something that could be sold to a wide audience, mostly of non-Manouche people. And so then starting in the 1980s, when this style of music that they were performing wasn't yet really named Jazz Manouche, but when it started becoming really marketable, this label just kind of developed. And it's kind of hard, I haven't been able to pinpoint exactly like who invented it. There are various stories that circulate about who did it, but it did emerge and started to become used pretty regularly in the media starting in the 1980s. And so one thing that I learned from some of my interlocutors was that early on, this was the kind of music that you would find just mixed up in the world music section of the record store. It was just, you know, like one of many quasi-exotic musics, I guess. But then when you started getting into the 90s, especially the late 90s and the early 2000s in France, you started to see jazz manouche become its own category, often as a subgenre of jazz. So it kind of transitioned from a more quote-unquote folkloric genre to something that was gaining a bit more distinctiveness and respectability. And so this respectability, of course, was depended largely on the fact that it was so closely associated with Django, who, again, occupied this space of being both an important figure in French heritage, but also in manouche heritage. And so I would say that jazz manouche kind of peaked in popularity probably at some point in the 2000s and really culminated in 2010 with the 100th anniversary of Django's birth. So there were a whole bunch of events and record releases and that sort of thing right around then. And since then, it's become, or it's remained a highly recognizable genre, but it hasn't been quite all the rage as it was over a decade ago, but it's still become like really recognizable, again, for both its French and manouche dimensions. And that, of course, has led in turn to a lot of ideas being propagated about what manouche identity is or should be or who manouche people are, based largely on just people's listening to this music and knowing that it's called jazz manouche.
This relates beautifully to an organization that you refer to in the book. And the organization, of course, organized in Alsace as a pro-Romani group, promoting Romani interests, whose leadership, as you write, was primarily made of non-Romani people for a long time. Could you talk about this organization and how they made use of what you call ambivalent essentialism?
Sure, absolutely. So this organization, it went by an acronym, which was APONA, and that is short for a mouthful of an organization name. It was called l'Association pour la Promotion des Populations d'Origine Nomade d'Alsace, which means the Association for the Promotion of Populations of Nomadic Origin of Alsace. So this was a nonprofit organization that was created in Alsace in the mid-1970s in response to some really serious racial violence that had been happening against manouche communities. And from its founding until its closure in the early 2000s, so we're talking a 25 plus year span, APONA was basically a social services organization that served mostly manouche communities as well as some other Romani or Romani adjacent communities. And they focused on building capacities in housing, healthcare, education, and employment. But one really important aspect of their work was cultural development and promotion. And so right from the beginning, the leaders were committed to using music as a way of both raising awareness about manouche people and then also developing a kind of economic niche in which manouche musicians could be successful and even become ideally self-sufficient. So I talk about APONA at various points in the book, but chapter two is really where I delve into the history of this organization and its musical engagement. And that's where I really try to show both what motivated the organization's leaders to become so musically engaged at the time. But then I also look at the time that the organization existed. But then I also really try to look at the legacy that this organization has, especially in its musical legacy, and how people who were part of APONA way back when still continued, or at least try to continue to maintain this kind of musical legacy through various means, including a still functioning music school and other kinds of activities and organizations of which they're a part. So it's basically about like the afterlife of APONA. And so one of the things I focus on is how APONA through its promotional work did or engaged in a process that I call in the book ambivalent essentialism. which is a term I coined to basically capture the kinds of tensions that are inherent to the process of essentialization in all its forms. So I use this term to name the contradictions and also the compromises that are involved when a group is essentialized or essentializes itself toward particular ends. So in the case of Aponeb, for them, promoting Jazz Manouche as uniquely Manouche basically was a way for them to say that Manouche people are the best purveyors of this music because it's part of their communities, because they have a certain knack for it, and because this music is a crucial part of their identity. And so Aponeb felt that this was overall like a really a good thing and something that was worthy of promoting, again, to bring a dimension of respectability to this population that had otherwise been quite marginalized. But the problem is that when you promote an entire ethno-racial group as valuable primarily in terms of a specific musical practice, you are also clearly doing a lot of essentializing, and you're really foreclosing a lot of possibilities for them to be considered in all of their many dimensions, which might not be musical. They might not be jazz manouche. They might be many other dimensions. So you're basically kind of pigeonholing them into a particular category. So the ambivalent part of ambivalent essentialism is really getting at the experience of being, at least in this case, one of those essentialized musicians who, on the one hand, wants to capitalize on this pretty successful ethno-racial branding, but then on the other hand, wants to be taken seriously as an artist, regardless of what their ethno-racial background is, and to be able to define themselves on their own terms. Yeah, I'll say to be honest, for me, this is one of the most valuable concepts I think that I develop in the book, because I think it adds some nuance to discussions of essentialism more broadly. And I really hope that it can be applied to a whole range of other contexts in which essentialism is deemed really problematic. And I just, you know, in developing this, I really wanted to capture all of the contradictions that I was observing and to, you know, account for how people were actually feeling and how they could change how they felt about this essentialism at various points in their careers or even in their days or within a conversation. You know, all of these kinds of contradictions started piling up, and I really wanted to do justice to what I was seeing there. So that's kind of one of the themes that came out for me when I was researching Aponeb in both its past and present iterations.
And one of the people who does this most powerfully throughout the book is Gigi, one of your interlocutors. Can you elaborate a little bit on Gigi here?
Sure. So yeah, Gigi, I kind of knew from the start he would probably play an important role in this project. But so Gigi Loeffler, he is someone that I met pretty early on in my field work, who kind of immediately took an interest in me, and I took an interest in him, and we both were kind of like on the same page about certain things. And so he became a pretty good friend, a really good friend pretty quickly, and really became very invested in a lot of the kinds of questions that I was asking, because he had already been asking a lot of these questions himself. So Gigi is a Manouche guitarist who was born and raised and continues to live in Alsace. And at the time of my fieldwork, he was gigging pretty regularly as a rhythm guitarist. And he was also running a small jazz Manouche school, as well as doing a whole variety of activism-oriented projects and other kinds of performance projects as well. So when I met him, this was in the summer of 2013, he seemed like someone who could really show me a lot in terms of how a particular musician both does music as an end in itself. And he's, you know, very, very passionate about this music, you know, for himself and for his community. But how, you know, he would also use music as a means to achieve a variety of outcomes in the political sphere, economically speaking as well, both, again, for himself and his broader community. So Gigi is also someone who sees himself as really fundamentally Manouche, and he sees himself as not being fully assimilated, even though he participates a lot in the non-Manouche
world. He's you know, very, very embedded in it. He's, you know, he sees himself as being kind of between two worlds, as being like fully Manouche, but also like really wanting to engage with non-Manouche people and be part of that world as well. And so I found that to be, you know, really something that showed me a lot about how he conceptualized his own Manouche and non-Manouche identity, or, you know, facets of his identity, and then how he viewed other people as well. And so basically, you know, because I came became really close with him, and I got to follow what he did really closely, including all of the of the really high moments, the really, you know, big successes of his life and career, and then also some of the low moments as well. You know, because of that, and because of the fact that he really wanted me to tell his story, he wanted his story to get out there. I knew that I really needed to orient a lot of this book's narrative around this experience that I had with him, and I really wanted to show in a detailed and fairly capacious way all of the kinds of hopes and dreams that really get pinned to this music. And I thought he was a really good example of someone who invests so much in this music. And then, of course, how it telling this allowed me to show how ambivalent essentialism is kind of a necessary result of this kind of work when you invest so much, when you put so much responsibility onto a music like that. So Gigi is really, he's a thread throughout the book, but there are also a number of other people who are kind of main characters in the book, who show a lot of the different dimensions of the musical scene and of ambivalent essentialism, and with whom Gigi sometimes intersected and sometimes didn't. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that by including all of these different voices, I really wanted to show just how heterogeneous the jazz Manouche scene is in terms of its people, but also its goals and its orientations. And then by extension, I wanted to show how Manouche populations are really, you know, not monolithic at all. And so I think Gigi was just one of many stories, but like a really good story to tell.
One of these high moments comes at the beginning of the book, and then you also end the book with one of these low moments. Could you talk more about this opening scene of the book? Because I love it so much.
Sure, yeah. So this opening scene, I worked over this scene over many years, both thinking about it and writing about it. And so this was a scene, this basically it revolves around a concert that I went to that I videotaped and was present for, in which Gigi, as with many of the concerts that he put on, he envisioned it both as a gig, as, you know, a way to perform and make money and all of that, but also as a way to raise awareness about his community and really show what, you know, what he called like the beautiful sides of his community, and really become kind of a spokesperson for jazz Manouche and for Manouche communities writ large, even though you know, he's doesn't speak for everyone, of course, but he kind of saw himself in that way. And so at this show, things ended up, as I describe, I won't give too much away of this story, but things got a little chaotic. And so right in the middle of this moment of chaos, I was just kind of trying to take in everything that was going on. And there were a lot of things that I identified as being both reinforcing of certain negative stereotypes about Manouche people, but also showing some things that the Manouche performers up on stage were really proud of. And so when Gigi, he just kind of came up to me behind my shoulder and just kind of pointed at what was going on and said, "Now that's Manouche." I just had all these thoughts kind of going through my head of like, what is he talking about? Like, what is he referring to? And eventually I learned it was he was talking about the specific right hand technique that musicians were using. But that was a moment that in retrospect really opened up a lot for me in terms of, you know, what it could mean to be Manouche and what someone might be identifying. And this also gets back to the kind of raciosemiotic framework that I was outlining, is you have all of these different, essentially, signs that are being produced and recognized in this moment. And that, to me, that moment really encapsulated just how polyvalent the idea of Manouche identity can be. And even the one moment of sound can have so many different meanings. And so that was just, you know, moment that I recalled, but also that I picked up on video, that I was just like, oh yeah, okay, this says a lot. And it says a lot about how enthusiastic Gigi was about, not just about the right hand technique, but about what that represented more generally in terms of something that was unique and powerful, and something that really, for him, I think too, encapsulated what it meant to be Manouche. And I explained before, this right hand technique, it's very percussive. It is very powerful. It creates a very identifiable sound that has energy and you know, really pushes the music forward. So I think, you know, in that sense too, we could think of his idea of Manouche people being a forward moving kind of powerful force. I think that also said something about what Gigi was thinking at the time.
And then you end the book with a barbecue that doesn't go Gigi's way.
Yeah. So the ending story, again, I don't want to give too much away, but that story revolves around a day later in my field work in 2014, when I accompanied Gigi to a ceremony to name a new variety of rose that had been cultivated by a rose farm in Alsace. And he had worked really hard to, over the course of months, he had worked really hard to participate in the ceremony and bring not just the musical performance to it, but also to use it as a platform to talk about the existence of Manouche people in Alsace and the music that they're making, and how to name this new rose variety was being named after Django Reinhardt. So it had a little registered trademark on it and everything. And so, you know, Gigi, he was so used to Django's name and image being exploited in so many different contexts that, you know, he saw this opportunity as one in which he could actually try to reclaim a little bit of that and try to ensure that it wouldn't be fully exploited. But he ended up being pretty disappointed in the outcome of this ceremony. And so that was one of those moments as well where, you know, Gigi and I, like, we were close friends, and we are still close friends, but, you know, he was really very open to me at that point about how frustrating it was to see his efforts be continually stifled at every point, or at least so it seemed to him. Like, he made progress in certain ways, but there was just at a certain point no escaping the fact that people were going to exploit Django's name. They were going to make stereotypes about Manouche people. They were always going to do this, and it was, you know, kind of an inescapable fact. And so I think this realization that, you know, he had time and time again was one that I also had over time. And I'll admit that I went into this project with a very, very optimistic idea of what music could do and what kind of potential music would have for Manouche, specifically Manouche activists, like in terms of raising awareness. And, you know, I had seen and read a lot about how music, especially in the US context and other contexts as well, had been used for this, you know, this powerful force for change. And I was really motivated by that. And then when I saw how it actually played out, when I did, you know, the really deep on the ground ethnography, I saw, like, no, that's not how music usually works. You know, it is an industry, it's a business, and it's not something that is necessarily going to have that kind of transformative effect, no matter how much people want to invest it with that prospect. So rather than, you know, become disappointed by this, or, you know, treat it as some kind of failure, I decided, as I was writing the dissertation and the book, to just really treat this as part of what actually happens. And, you know, I don't mean to shortchange or to speak ill about the efforts that people are making in terms of music-centered activism by any means. I'm just, I wanted to reflect kind of the realities and the pros and cons and, you know, the highs and lows of how people actually try to use music towards these political and economic ends. And I found that it was just a really mixed bag, and I wanted to attend to how mixed it could be, and how, you know, even with all of the failures that it can have, that doesn't mean that the whole thing is a failure. It's just, you know, something that something to be careful about, I guess I could say, if that's one of the messages of the book.
And I think you capture that brilliantly. This is easily one of my favorite books that I've read this year. This was such a joy to read. And there are so many things that, of course, we unfortunately don't have time to get to. As you know, there is one tradition on the New Books Network that I always uphold, which is to end the interview by asking what you are working on now.
Great. Well, thank you so much for all of these kind words about the book. So the what's next question. So my current project is about minutiae approaches to commemorating the Romani genocide that was waged during World War II. And this is something that I touch on in the book, and I actually have a whole chapter about this in my dissertation, or at least about one way in which some minutiae cultural producers did a genocide focused work. But the subject was kind of tangential to the main subjects in the book, even though I've been researching and thinking about it for basically just as long as I've been researching jazz minutiae. And so one of my main motivations for this new project has to do with the fact that it has been a very long and uphill battle for minutiae to even get a little bit of recognition for what they endured during World War II at the hands of the Nazis, and then also at the hands of French authorities, with the Vichy governments and all of that. And so it's not only recognition that some people have been trying to get, but reparations is something that minutiae people have had basically zero access to, despite other groups getting their due. Not all of them, but still, it's something that that the French government has really just not recognized nearly as much as they should. And so a big factor in this lack of recognition and reparations is the idea that's pretty widespread in both scholarship and media that minutiae people don't talk about the war and that they don't talk about dead people. They don't talk about traumatic events. And so there's this idea that they either don't want to or aren't able to tell the story of what happened to them and their communities that they won't tell the story to any kind of public audience. But as I was doing my research throughout it, I found that to the contrary, there were plenty of instances in which minutiae people do speak out in various ways about past trauma, and especially about the war and the effects that it's had on their communities. And so so this project is going to be another one that is both ethnographic and archival. It's going to be one in which I will try not only to thread together some of the stories that are told across various art forms, including literature, especially the testimonial genre, and through music and through filmmaking as well. So I'm going to, show what's been done and what continues to be done, what people hope will be done. But I'm also really trying to push back against this very essentializing idea that minutiae people either won't or cannot participate in contemporary frameworks for genocide commemoration. So I've already written a couple of articles about this, and I've done some cursory field work, but if all goes to plan, I will be in France next fall to do some more in-depth field work, and then hopefully also work with some of my interlocutors to develop some kind of web-based media to help further their awareness-raising goals. So that's really what's in store. It's not the most uplifting topic, but it's something that I feel particularly compelled to do, largely because of what I've observed, and also there's a personal dimension to this motivation as well, which is that my father was a political prisoner of the Nazis during World War II, and he was sent to various concentration camps, and of course survived to tell his story, but he actually didn't tell his story until relatively late in his life because he was, for various reasons having to do with PTSD and all of that. But I've grown up with this story because he started telling it around the time I was born. And it's become like so much part of who he, the person that I knew him as. It's his shift from going from being very silent about this experience to becoming very public about it is something that I, also see in how minutiae people are portrayed in terms of the genocide. So there's that personal dimension too. So I'm hoping to basically create a book project as well as this more kind of interlocutor focused
media project as well. Something that can be useful for them at the same time.
And once the book project is completed, of course, I would love to have you back on the show.
I would love to be back. This has been a real pleasure.
The book is Django Generations, published in 2021 with the University of Chicago Press. Professor Steve B. Lee, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.